Okay, welcome back to the highest-rated late-night talk show in the world. Good to have you with us as we talk with John Lott this hour and take your phone calls about concealed weapons. If you've ever had to pull it and you are a concealed weapons holder, check in with us. And the court system, if you've been in court, tell me what that was like. We'll be back with John and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I'm watching the clock here in L.A., and it's 11:11. That number just keeps popping up all over the place. John Lott with us, his latest work, Dumbing Down the Courts. And, of course, More Guns, Less Crime, The Bias Against Guns and Freedomnomics as well. John, as you know, and as I've told you over the years, I'm a concealed weapons permit holder as well. And I gotta tell you, it was worth doing. You learn something. You understand guns. You learn how to respect what a gun is, and more importantly, you're protected.
Right. Look, my research finds that the police are extremely important. They're, I believe, the single most important factor for reducing crime. But I think the police understand themselves that they almost always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And that raises the question, what should people do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? And having a gun is by far the safest course of action for people to take. And you're not alone anymore. The Crime Prevention Research Center, we just put out a report a couple months ago that indicates that they're now it's approaching almost 12 million Americans that have concealed carry permits. And that doesn't even count the fact that there's a few states we weren't able to get information on. And then there are six states that no longer require people to have permits in order to carry. So the number of people who legally carry is going to be much larger than that 12 million.
And I've got to tell you, we have seen cases, case in point, Oklahoma again, where a concealed weapons permit holder or someone who has the ability to carry has been in the right place at the right time, and has helped a lot of people.
Right. I mean, everything from what would have been major shootings at churches to universities to schools to other workplaces, even to downtown areas, you've seen stopped by concealed carry permit holders. And just like in this case, it gets relatively little attention. But the only time they give them attention is if they can go and emphasize that this person was a part-time reserve sheriff's deputy. You know, if it's just in his capacity as an executive there and a concealed carry permit holder, which is what allowed him to carry a gun around regularly. Of course, it was his place of business, which allowed him flexibility too. You know, that part that they pretty much ignore. But, you know, there's a reason why when these criminals do, you know, mass shootings, they pick places where guns aren't allowed.
That's
because
exactly
they hope
right.
And they believe that the victims that they're going to be able to attack aren't going to be able to defend themselves.
Even though some of them are cowards and they kill themselves.
Right. Well, they want to kill themselves. They want to die. You know, these people, when they commit these types of mass shootings, are doing it as a way to commit suicide, but they feel neglected. They want people to know that they were here.
Yeah.
And it's chilling just to read the documents that are left there to indicate how very consciously they plan these things. Take two shootings from this year, the Santa Barbara shooting. I don't know if people have read the 141-page manifesto that the shooter left there, but two things came out very clearly. One, he felt he was unappreciated. Women didn't like him enough. Others didn't like him enough. And so he was going to end his life. But the second thing that comes across is the minute planning that he went into and the types of things that went into his calculations where to attack. There's actually three discussions which are very similar that talk about why he didn't go after other targets. One example was spring break. Apparently in California, Santa Barbara is kind of like the in place for students from around the state to go for spring break. And he said this would be a perfect place for him to go after these women that didn't appreciate him, guys who he didn't think appreciated him enough either. But he said he decided not to do it because when he was reviewing past YouTube videos of spring break there in Santa Barbara, he noticed that there were a lot of cops. He said if there was just one or two cops, he could go and kill the cops first before he killed other people. But with so many cops there, it would be impossible for him to go and kill all of them before he'd be able to go and start shooting at the students that were there. You look at even in Canada this summer, in Moncton, New Brunswick, this got almost no coverage, but the killer there, this mass shooter, on his Facebook page had a number of comics about gun-free zones. He had several that were the same theme. There would be a victim that was there who would be saying, look, you can't have a gun here. This is a gun-free zone. They're banned. You can't shoot me. And the attacker who's shooting people right before he shoots the person who's saying that is thinking to himself, what a moron, and then he shoots him. And, you know, this is a guy who engaged in a mass shooting in a gun-free zone. You know, it's hard to think of how much more explicit these people could make it.
But absolutely.
When you see the media coverage of these things, the media just refuses to mention whether or not these attacks occur in places where guns are banned. If even some news reports would go into, you know, the same type of coverage that they do for what type of gun was used, you know, how he obtained the gun, things that they frequently get wrong in the initial stories, my guess is the entire gun debate would be quite different today.
All right, let's go to the phones now for the rest of the hour. Got a full bank of calls here. Mike is in Costa Mesa, California. We'll get you started here. Michael, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. And George, I'm a longtime listener. Great show.
Thank you, Mike.
I was on a federal trial in 1992. That was during the Rodney King riots, which happened on the day of our deliberation. And I am so disillusioned with the court system. I totally agree with your guest speaker. The judge fell asleep two times. when I knew I was going to be on the jury, I practiced in front of the mirror, dumbing myself down, trying not to use big words. I had 6 years of college. I've had two law classes and eight real estate classes and worked in real estate. They asked me every stupid question except, you know, are you an attorney? No. Is your wife an attorney? No. Are you a real estate agent? No. Are you a broker? No. They didn't ask me if I took eight real estate classes or even one. They didn't ask me if I ever took a law class. You know, and my friends were just cheering me on the entire week, and it was just fascinating. The poor guy they had on there, I knew exactly what he did, and he wrote one letter and sent it out to 261 people, and they charged him with 261 counts of mail fraud.
Gosh.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know what you know how much time they gave him or what. You know, I kept asking the people in the court system. You know, can I go to the hearing? Could I go to see what the sentencing is going to be? And they all lied. I kept calling 2-3 times a day for a week, and I gave up after 2 weeks.
And Mike, with the judge falling asleep, I mean, how long did he doze off for?
One time I clocked it. It was over 20 minutes. I really had the urge to say, Judge, wake up. Now, you know what would have happened to me? I would have got hit with contempt of court probably.
Something,
one,
yeah.
3 days. Okay. Or if I fall asleep, I would have got hit with contempt of court. The other time was about 10 or 15 minutes. And the federal prosecutor, she kept raising her voice and raising her voice. She was almost screaming, and she was losing her voice, and the judge finally woke up. You know? And it was just ridiculous. And, jurors, I've never sat down with 11 dumber people in my life. It was like a joke to them. It was like a game. And when they were making mistakes, I couldn't tell them I've had two law classes. I don't know what kind of trouble I would have gotten into. And it was like a game with these people, you know. And this is a man's life at stake here, his profession, his life. Yes, what he did was not correct, but, you know, it was not that big of a deal. And when a lot of the people came in to testify for him, you know, I figured, oh, you know, he's going to get off. And then they brought the other people, and, you know, you can tell they were half lying. You know, he gave restitution. You know, there was no flight. They walked into the office and they put the handcuffs on him in front of all his employees. He didn't flee or nothing. And, you know, I figured, okay, give the guy a slap on the wrist 6 months, and God knows what he got for 261 counts. Now, this is, you know, that goes back to what the how they got some of the gangsters back in the 30s and 40s.
That's right, same way.
Yeah,
same
way. They haven't adjusted the court system.
What do you think of that, John Lott?
Well, yeah, no, it's an interesting story there. It, you know, two points. One is the very questions that they ask, you know, why, whether he's a lawyer, the reason why they care about that is a lawyer on a jury is going to have a lot of weight because the other members of the jury will defer to that person about what the law is.
That's right.
In their discussions. And also, lawyers tend to be relatively persuasive. They argue with people in court and other places all the time, so they get a lot of practice doing that. And that's the reason why they would ask that type of question. It's very difficult for a lawyer to get on a jury. But, you know, as far as the judge falling apart, that's pretty funny. One of the things that's interesting is that judges who have what's called good judicial temperament actually have a harder time getting on, getting confirmed than the ones who have poor judicial temperament. So it's not exactly working out the best to have people who kind of properly weigh the evidence. And you know, it's not only do you not get the smartest judges, but you also get ones who are kind of less desirable in other ways too.
Let's go to Toronto, Canada. I'll be there November 8th. By the way, Terry on the international line. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, John. The reason I have an interest in this is because, be it the UK, Canada, or the United States, all of our law devolves eventually to British common law and the jury system. And last hour, John said something in response to a question you posed to him. Would you prefer a judge-only trial versus a jury trial? And John's answer was jury. But I wanted to know if his opinion would change at all if it was a civil case and there were compensatory damages at stake, because we can't forget that it is the jury system that brought us the ridiculous awards for hot coffee and laps and so forth.
Well, that's a good point.
I mean, you can get some pretty ridiculous things even with a judge involved. But, look, you know, I guess in part the answer that I would give to that, I mean, I hear what you're saying. It would depend on what side I was on and something like that of the case. I agree. Juries, you at least have a somewhat higher probability of getting it. The thing is, you have an appeals process. If it is really a very ridiculous verdict, it's very likely to get appealed. And the judge himself doesn't have to take what the jury does. He can scale it back if he thinks it's unreasonable.
John, justice is blind. It makes mistakes. What would you say? It is still the best system available today?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm not sure what the alternative would be. You want to try to have an independent judiciary, I guess.
The Saudi Arabia way. They cut off your hands in a robbery.
Well, you know.
I'm being facetious.
I do think that more severe penalties make sure you have less crime. But you also can have errors in the system there, and having something like removing somebody's hands or having other types of things like that. I mean, they have executions for a range of crimes that we don't have here in the United States. I guess I'd be a little bit adverse to that.
Yeah, we're going to an anonymous city now to talk to an anonymous person. There you go. You're up with us.
Hi, how you doing?
We're fine.
I was just wanting to ask, what would you suggest doing about a corrupt judge? Because in the next county over, there is someone who should not be a judge. In fact, he should probably more than likely be in prison for committing crimes up to and including murder, selling cocaine out of the courthouse, flying it in on a private jet, and just a number of things. But if you stick your head up in that county, things will happen to you. And it's you know, that's why I wanted to remain anonymous, of course.
I understand. Right. And, of course, he probably hasn't been convicted yet, but they don't seem to be attacking the judge. Why aren't they going after the judge?
It's a small town, and they kind of do things the way that they want to do them, and they have their own versions of the law.
So what do you do, John Lott, with a corrupt judge?
Well, you know, the first thing you would do is go to law enforcement, but obviously that's not working, so you could go to state.
How about the feds? Can you do
that? Or you can go to the federal government and report the information that you know there. You know, it's one of the benefits of having kind of different levels of government there to oversee the actions of somebody like that. I mean, if you really have evidence of these types of crimes, corruption, and it sounds like much worse type violent crimes, those are the people that you would go to with it.
Hey, if anybody's a judge, check in with us. Love to chat with you. How do you feel about the elected procedure in townships and cities as opposed to appointments?
Well, you know, I think there's one benefit from having appointed judges, and that is I think a bar association probably has less sway on average in terms of who's going to end up getting appointed than you have with elections. Because often, as you mentioned before, a lot of people don't have a clue who the people are who are running for judgeships. They just see whether the person's already a judge or not. The Bar Association tends to have a lot more information on those individuals, and they tend to vote much more frequently for those types of offices. And so, you know, if you believe that the Bar Association tends to be relatively liberal on those things, you might want to change it to have appointed. If you don't mind judges like that, then you probably want to keep things the way they are.
On a 1 to 10, how would you categorize the problem of the dumbing down of the court system, with 10 being the highest?
I think it's significant. Yeah. I think the types of bright people that you have is dramatically lower. I'd say it's probably about a 5 in terms of problems, you know, in terms of the scope of the world, maybe 6.
Well, and then you get these court cases where maybe somebody's truly innocent and they get convicted, they get put away for a number of years, and then by a miracle something saves them, a DNA case or something.
Right. Well, I mean, that's one reason why you generally would like to have the best and brightest judges there to go and sort out evidence better than somebody else would. And, you know, ideally you want to have somebody who's not politically biased, who's very smart on the courts. A lot of these regulations are very complicated. They've gotten much more complicated over time. And you know, not everybody's able to go and figure out whether somebody's actually violated a rule or not.
We're going to come back and take final calls with John Lott on Coast to Coast AM. Beyond Belief, that's our television program. By the way, I was on Jesse Ventura's program today. I'll tell you the exact date. You can watch that on his show. And Beyond Belief, of course, is available for you to watch all the programs you want for 10 days. Simply go to this website, beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. You look like you have a number of justices and lawyers who are in the know, John, that support your work with dumbing down the courts.
Yeah, no, I think... it's something that they'll tell you in private or even speak out once in a while on. But you have people like Richard Posner, who's probably the best-known appeals court judge in the country. I have strong quotes from him in the book and other places saying that, you know, they realize that the smartest people have had the hardest time getting confirmed. I'll just give you one example of the type of difficulties that go on. You look at the American Bar Association ratings. The three appeals court judges who have by far the most cites from other judges, so that's probably the best measure of influence that you can have, are Dick Posner, Frank Easterbrook, and I'm drawing a blank on the last one there, but those three also got the lowest ABA ratings when they were nominated. Richard Posner, when he was nominated, got 8 qualified votes and 7 unqualified votes. You can either get well-qualified, qualified, or unqualified. No one who's gotten more unqualified votes than qualified votes has ever been confirmed, but Posner came the closest. And Frank Easterbrook, who both of these guys just get, they're like in another universe in terms of the number of citations that other judges give to their opinions, kind of representing kind of the esteem that judges from both parties put on these judges. And yet when they came up, the types of criticisms that you would see kind of off the record in newspapers from people who were on the panel was that they were dangerously brilliant, that their opponents were afraid that they would have too much influence on the courts.
All right, to the phones we go now. We shall go to Aurora, Colorado. Tyler's with us. Tyler, get us going. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi. It's a huge honor to be on the show, and I'm a little nervous. There's one thing I want to say. I'll try to keep it down to below 60 seconds for the other callers. There's one thing I want to say, and then I have one question.
Sure.
First off is I'm a former inmate of the Colorado Department of Corrections, and I was in county jail for quite a while there, and all I had was your show, George, and you got me through a really hard time, and there are a lot of good people that have made mistakes and are trying to better themselves and put things behind them. And good people go to prison every day, and that's something you don't hear a lot of people say. But there's people right now that you're carrying through, that you're their only source of information, and it just means a whole lot to be on the show and to let you know that.
Thank
it's
you.
A huge honor. Second of all, there's a lawsuit against the Colorado Department of Corrections concerning the good time and earned time that they're giving inmates. And from my understanding, it's going to be a class action lawsuit, and I would be a part of that. But it has the potential of releasing thousands of inmates from prison if it goes through, I guess you'd say. And they have taken thousands of years from inmates on top of that. And I was wondering if you've heard about that. The news isn't really covering that at all. And it's a great honor to be on the show. Thanks, George.
You're very welcome. John, have you heard about that?
No, I haven't followed that particular case. But, in the federal system, there's very little good time that you can get to reduce sentences. And one of the problems that creates is just makes it more difficult to go and control prisoners. I mean, if you have the threat that if somebody misbehaves in prison, their sentence will be longer than it would have been otherwise. That at least gives the prison warden and the guards some tool for keeping people in line that they otherwise wouldn't have had. As far as the individual state goes, it varies a lot across states.
All right, back to David now in Tucson, Arizona, west of the Rockies. David, you're on with John Lott. Go ahead.
Hey, Jordan, John. I was going to switch it up a little bit and talk about concealed carry.
Sure.
And basically, if you don't mind, about just surviving a basic gunfight or a deadly force situation in the real world. And one of the things that I find in just seeing people at gun ranges and instructors, and it's good to go to the gun range, there's nothing wrong with that, but you have a table there and you place your handgun there, and there's like a little bag, and you lift it up and you shoot at this target 10, 15, 20 feet away. Very few people take into consideration one of the most important things is not so much the caliber you carry or the type of gun, but how you carry it, what's your holster, and is it feasible to draw from sitting in the chair in your car while you're at a drive-through late at night, or you're at the ATM, are you going to be able to have it accessible quickly and ready, and is it going to be ready for you? So just your comments on that, and thank you, George.
Okay, you're welcome.
Well, thanks. I mean, surely being able to quickly access your gun is important. Practicing so you have, you're comfortable with it. And I suppose the other thing is just being aware of your surroundings. I mean, if you're an ATM, you at least have some awareness whether somebody maybe coming towards you might be a threat or not. not so that you brandish your gun or whatever at any slight thing that may occur, but just that you, you know, are cognizant of that and move your hand in accordance so that you can quickly access it if it really becomes necessary.
We have now Don in Philadelphia, first-time caller for us. Go ahead, Donald. Good to have you with us. Yeah. Hi.
Yeah, first-time caller. I've been on Bill days.
Thank you.
I just turned 80 years old this month. I ex-military. At one time, I was the armor on duty in Germany. And I wanted to ask John, do you remember Masoud Abdu?
Oh, sure. I know him. He's a trainer.
I have all his books here. I carry a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum, which I can shoot 38s out of it. We have a lot of crime here in Philadelphia. It's terrible. Every day somebody's getting shot, and I don't know how to stop it, but that's what I waited on. Yeah. I think my personal home weapon would be the Mossberg 500. Do you agree with that?
Well, I mean, shotguns are valuable. I think within a home, having a handgun is a little bit easier to wield when you're
I'm 8 years old, and my wife is here. We have grandchildren. But I also have a Colt 45. I have a German Luger upstairs and a safe. And I'm what you call gun nut. I also am selling hand-to-hand combat, so I really appreciate what you've done, and I want to give you a heads up.
I appreciate George having me on to talk about these things. Look, Philadelphia has serious crime problems. As I said earlier, I think police are important. I think they're the single most important factor, but you have a number of cities, whether it be Chicago or Philadelphia, where police are doing a pretty bad job in terms of clearance rates for crimes. And Chicago, the clearance rate is 26%. That means they're solving 26% of the murders that occur there. In Philadelphia, it's a little bit higher, but still less than 30%. The national average you're talking about is about 60% in terms of clearance rates. So, but when you have those types of problems, individuals have to be able to go and defend themselves. You know, you have a case that recently got a lot of news from a woman in Philadelphia who had got a concealed handgun permit in Philadelphia because of crime there. She has two young kids, a single mother, and she had driven across the bridge into New Jersey, not realizing the laws were different there, and looked like she was facing really long prison time there for carrying a gun in New Jersey, where they don't allow people to, you know, carry except under extremely restrictive conditions. Fortunately, just in the last week, that was changed. But, you know, it's too difficult in many places for people to figure out what the rules are. But, you know, it's ultimately it's dependent upon the individuals to be able to go and defend themselves.
Jared's in Evansville, Indiana, east of the Rockies. Jared, thank you. Go ahead.
How you doing, George and John? First-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you, sir.
I just want to first start by saying that the police officers today, they need to be well-trained for the simple fact is that they have been shooting a lot of unarmed people here lately. And I also have been trained as a bodyguard down in Nashville, Tennessee, which is a training program. And I got my certification. But we learned how to, maintain control and everything, and not just quick to jump and pull out a gun on somebody, you know, and kill them. So, what's your take on that? I'm just going to keep it short.
Right. Well, I mean, I wish there was better data than we have collected on accidental shootings by police. It's something that isn't really reported very systematically. And one thing that is interesting to me is when you see a civilian have to use a gun defensively, how rarely they fire the gun, particularly in things like these mass shootings. You know, there's only a couple cases literally, where you find that permit holders have had to fire their guns in order to stop these attacks. I mean, one of the more dramatic one was the New Life Church in Colorado about 5 years ago, where there are literally hundreds of lives that may have been in danger in that case, and the permit holder had to shoot the attacker like 10 times. But in the vast majority of cases, simply brandishing a gun, pointing it at the attacker, is sufficient to cause them to go and break off the attack and to stop. And, you know, it's the rate at which they fire is much lower than it is for police. And part of that might be the fact that civilians worry that they have a lot at stake if they make a mistake. You know, maybe in some cases they're even too careful. But there is some difference in terms of the willingness that they are willing to go and use their guns versus police.
We've got Barbara in Los Angeles. It's your turn, Barbara. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to know. I noticed here in L.A. County they're really punitive about serving you with a jury summons, and if you don't respond, you get jail time and a $1,500 fine, plus you still have to serve. And, like, to get out of a medical situation, if you want to be excused on medical grounds, you have to kind of push for that, too. And I was just wondering, does any of this have an impact on the kind of verdicts that people deliver in the jury room when they're kind of, you know, being recruited punitively and not getting good pay and respect? And I'll listen off the air.
Right. Now, that's an interesting question. Look, I mean, if people don't want to be there, if they really are trying to get off the jury duty as quickly as possible, they may not be willing to go and fight for what they think is right as hard as they would otherwise. Yeah, I think people like George, myself, don't have to worry about being on jury pools. But for the rest of people, you know, they end up serving more frequently than they otherwise would have had to serve. You know, do more than their share in a sense.
And jurors get paid what, about $35 a day?
I don't know in California. It varies a huge amount by state. You know, in a number of places, it's just basically enough to go and pay for lunch and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if the jury trial lasts 6 months, you're stuck on that jury, aren't you?
Right. I mean, you can go and claim some type of financial hardship in order to stay off the case, and then it's up to the judge essentially to determine whether or not you know the hardship you face is severe enough. You know, they view it as essentially part of the tax that you pay for being a citizen to have to go and serve it. But sure, you know, it's unusual for cases to last that long. It's really, you know, really high-profile cases with people spending a lot on lawyers to have cases last that long. But surely that's the cost that you risk facing.
Let's go to William Truck Driving in Indiana. William, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
What I'm calling about the whole gun control, and what I'm saying is this is coming from somebody who's been on both sides. I've been shot and have guns pulled on me. I grew up in California, Southern California, and I've also been trained on how to handle a firearm. My view and my opinion is that if you, like you guys have been saying, and pretty much everywhere that you look at in the states that have no gun control or have gun control, no guns permitted in the state, they have a much higher crime rate. My thought and opinion is that they should take more initiative, just like how they have first responders for EMS. They should have more people trained on how to handle a firearm. And because if there's more people out there that are able and properly trained on how to handle a firearm, then there's less likely people that are going to make any attempts to attack and do any shooting, because they're going to be more likely afraid to get shot themselves. And if they are not afraid, if they are suicidal, and they're either way, they're going to do it, there might as well be somebody there that is more likely to stop them before they can injure or do more damage than what there is and take them out quickly. And I was wondering what your thought is on this, John. And thank you again. I'll take your answer offline.
Sure. Very welcome.
All right, well, I mean, I think these terrorist-type attacks try to find places where victims can't defend themselves. My research has indicated to me that the amount of time that elapses between once an attack starts and when somebody is able to arrive on the scene with a gun, whether it be a police officer or whether it is a civilian who has a concealed handgun permit, the longer the amount of time, the more carnage that you're going to have. And you've seen the people explicitly talk about this in their planning more than a few times. And just looking at these attacks, if they were random, the 98-99% of the time that you have these attacks, they'd be occurring where guns were allowed instead of virtually all of them occurring in those relatively small places in a lot of states where guns are not allowed. So, you know, there's cost to requiring training. You take some place like Illinois. Right now it costs $150 fee to get your permit, and then you have to have 16 hours of training, including 2 hours of range time. It's costing about $650 for somebody to go through the process to go and get a permit. And so you have to be careful there because what's going to happen is that you're going to have relatively fewer people get permits. And it's also going to change the mix of people who are going to get permits. My research indicates to me that one of the groups that benefit the most are basically poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. The people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime are the ones who benefit the most from having the option to be able to protect themselves. But if you have $650, I mean, we're not even talking about the cost of the gun or the cost of going out
That's
and practicing.
Right. Double that.
Just $650 to go through the process to go and get a permit. Plus, you know, you're not allowed to take the gun on public transportation. There are no places to go and train within the city of Chicago, for example. All those things basically mean that poor people don't get permits. And, you know, so you have to be careful that you're not making it impossible for people to even have the option to be able to go, at least law-abiding citizens, to defend themselves. The criminals, the gang members in those areas aren't paying $650 before they go and carry their guns.
No, they don't. They don't need it. John, thank you so much. His latest work, Dumbing Down the Courts, up next. Walter Crittenden joins us as we talk about the binary star systems.